Let's see, hold on.
Yeah, that's.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro, and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. It's truly a show about tone and some interesting guitars, technique, everything. My guest is Jay Gore.
Hello.
And an amazing session man and artist. You can hear him there. And I just was going through his... We're going to take a look at some of the clips from his latest album, Guitronica. And it's some amazing guitar tones and just great guitar playing in general. But he's a real good equipment guy, and he knows his gear really well. So we're going to dig in deep in how he gets his tone, because... This guitar that he's using here and the one he uses on this album is amazing. So welcome to the show. It's
great. Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Let me get this closer to you. There we go.
And briefly, give us a little bit of your background.
I'm born and raised here in lovely Los Angeles, California.
A native.
I am a native.
Very cool.
Grew up in West LA.
Okay.
Not far from Century City. And went to... GIT in the heyday of the 80s.
The original one.
The original GIT. Actually, it was a one-year school then, and my first 6 months were in the original building, which is kind of above the Wax Museum on Hollywood Boulevard.
Right, right.
And then they told us, you know, your second, you're going to be moving across the street into our new building. We're building some state-of-the-art. And I remember we would have some classes on Hollywood Boulevard and some classes on McCadden Place.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I remember the year. So you were, did you meet Howard?
Yes.
So you got, yeah. Because he was the original founder of Guitar Institute. But I've told some of the other people that here that were alumni, I went to school at SC with Duke Miller,
okay.
who taught Lee Ritenour.
Right.
And they were buddies. So he would tell us what you guys were doing. And it was pretty, what Howard was doing at the time was pretty revolutionary.
Yeah.
Because you used a lot of, you could go in it. I know some of my friends that went there part time, and they could go in late at night, and there were tapes.
You could. It was incredible. You had a time. You had a card, a time card, like an old factory job. You know, you had a time card, and you'd punch in, and yes, you could go. You had a schedule. You know, Monday you had this teacher for this class from these times, but if you couldn't make it. Because you had a day job or something, you could go in there at midnight and walk into the video library and say to the librarian, hey, I need week 3 of single string technique. And then they'd say, which teacher do you want? Because they had each teacher teaching each class on video.
Right.
So if you didn't want to hear the lesson given by the teacher you were assigned to, you could go in and say, I'd like to see, you know, week six of single string technique taught by Norman Brown, you know, or taught by Steve Trovato, or taught by Scott Henderson.
Yeah.
You know, and you take your electric guitar and you bring your headphones with you and a pencil and a cable and then a little box, they're little cubicles. And they'd say, okay, go to cubicle 15. And you'd sit in the cubicle and there'd be a little tiny TV and the video would come on and you'd plug your guitar into a little box and your headphones into a little box and you had room for your notebook with all your curriculum and you could play along with the videos. It was incredible because some people learn that way, which was revolutionary at the time. We're talking about the 80s right now.
Yeah.
And I mean, now people are used to putting on YouTube and listening to some guy going, you know. You know, teaching them how to play, you know, scales or whatever. But back in those days, you didn't have that. You had those Starlix videos, which were pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember those. Yeah. But it was interesting because, like, my friend, he was in dental school. So he would go there, like, at midnight.
Right.
It was around the clock.
And right. You could just go
in.
Day.
So you'd go in there in the wee hours of the morning, and there'd be all these people in there with right. the listening.
For them to be accredited, they explained to us, for them to have accreditation, you had to spend X amount of hours per week in school. And they knew that people had day jobs. So they said, you know, you could come in and clock in at night. As long as you take the tests and pass the tests, you're going to get, I mean, they gave you a certificate then. They didn't have.
Right, right.
There was no degree program then.
Yeah.
I don't have any kind of degree in music or anything like that. I have just that I went to GIT for a year. That's all I have, you know.
Like certificate of completion.
Yeah, it's like, that's it. That's all they gave you. Now I think they have.
And your punch card.
Right. I wish I still had that.
I don't think it's a, it was like a accreditation, like a technical, you know, like there was like for LA Trade Tech, there was
right
for, you know, automotive. You'd get
right. It has to be some kind of certificate.
Yeah, no, it was a college degree, but it wasn't a baccalaureate, you know, bachelor's. You
right. Bachelor's. No, definitely not. You definitely were not getting a bachelor's degree or anything like that. Yeah, it was probably like a trade school thing. You're right.
But it was designed for you to hit the road. That was a problem at SC before Duke came in, was the fact that all these classical players, they had no clue how to get a job.
Right.
Unless they were teachers.
That's what GIT taught. And they said that. Because the thing was, what they used for their branding was they had these great pictures of Eddie Van Halen and Alan Holdsworth and guys like that teaching in the school, like on the stage at the school. And I was like, I want to go there. You know, I remember saying to my parents, I want to go to this school so badly. Eddie Van Halen was there, you know. And the second you get in there, they talk to you about two things. One is the trout look. I'll never forget them talking about the trout look. The trout look was, after X amount of weeks, some people will be two, some people will be six, you start walking around in the halls of the class looking like a trout. You're just burnt out. Like yeah. you think
overkill.
Right, overkill. If you get past that trout look, you'll last all year. Those who don't, drop out.
Right.
Right. And then they said, this is not rock star school. This is, we're going to teach you how to make a living playing your guitar. That's it. They start teaching you songs that I'm going to go play at Harvell's tonight. You know?
Amazing.
I mean, you know, songs every musician needs to know. Everything from the Sinatra stuff to Stevie Wonder songs to, you know, bossa novas. So all the stuff that you need to be a working guitar player.
Ageless, timeless.
Right. The standards.
Yeah.
And not just jazz standards, pop standards, rock standards. You know what I mean? I remember the first week we had to learn... Yeah. Right.
I forget the name of that, but I remember.
Freeway Jam. Jeff Beck.
Jeff Beck, yeah.
And then they taught us, you know. You know, Mercy, Mercy, Mercy.
Yep.
They taught us all that stuff. You know, all that stuff that you play. Sissy Strut. All that.
And I want everybody to notice, listen to the tone of that guitar. It's to die for.
Yeah.
So how did you, from Guitar Institute, that's how you got into sessions and gigging from there, or did you?
I was already gigging.
Oh.
I started gigging when I was 13. I had a band. We were all in the eighth grade. And we wrote our own songs. We were diligent little kids, man. We would meet, and I remember this so well. We met on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday. And then one day on the weekend, either Saturday or Sunday, depending on my Little League schedule. If I had a game on a Sunday, we rehearsed on Saturday. If it was Saturday, we rehearsed on Sunday. And we would get together. Seriously, if we got out of school at like 3:15 p.m., by 3:30, we were in the garage. Gear was already set up. You know, me going, hey, man, I got this new lick, this new riff, you know. Oh, that's cool. And the drummer would start playing a beat, and the other guitar player would, like, add to that, and we'd always have to teach it to the bass player because he didn't know what he was doing. Yeah. Yeah, and we wouldn't even invite our singer to these jams, to these kind of writing sessions. We would make sure we had the tunes down, and we'd record them on our cassette recorder, then give them to the singer, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah, but we were, I mean, we wrote all our, when we got, I remember, so we went, my drummer Craig and I, who's still one of my very good friends, rode our bicycles up Doheny to the Troubadour after school one day, and we went into the alley, and we went into that, like there was a band loading in, for their show that night, and we just walked in the back door from the alley, and we walked up into the office, and there's a guy up there named Mike, and we said, hey man, we want to play here. And he's like, get out of here. Who let you in here, you know? And we said, no, we've got a band, we're called Frequency, and we're great, man. You're going to want us in here. We're going to pack this place. And he didn't believe us. He goes, let me hear your demo tape. We said, what's a demo tape? He said, I need a tape. I need a cassette of your band. You need to go to a studio. We're like, we don't. In those days, nobody had home studios.
Right.
Yeah. So we begged our parents to give us money for recording. And they gave us the money. We went into the recording studio. And we made a 3 or 4 song demo. And we tracked it live. You know, just all of us in a room together, which is gobos between our amps and the drums. And I remember we did three passes of every song. And when we went back and listened to it, it's funny, as I have pictures of myself in that studio session when I was 12 or 13. I don't know if I turned 13 yet, but it was the year that I would have been 13. And I remember sitting down behind the console, and I said to the guy whose studio it was, I said, I want to know what every one of these knobs and switches does. I did. I said that to him. And we did that. We did that demo, and we brought the demo back to the guy. And he listened to it, and he went, how do I know this is you?
Oh, goodness.
Seriously. We're like, come on, man. Of course it's us. Why would we bring you somebody else's music? He's like, it happens all the time.
Oh, wow.
He goes, I don't know that this is you. You're like 12, 13-year-old kids. I don't believe you can play like this. So we invited him to band practice. And he actually came.
Wow.
He actually showed up at our band practice where our singer had to stand outside. We're in the garage playing, and our singer, the garage door is shut, and our singer's outside singing in the driveway. He couldn't stand in the garage with us because the feedback from the PA system would just be, if the microphone was in the same room. We didn't know anything. We were using an omnidirectional microphone. Those of you who don't know what that is, that's a microphone that picks up from every direction.
Yeah, this one's unidirectional. Right. It cancels.
Right. Normally a singer will use a microphone that's only picking up right there.
And
right,
you know
right.
The sweet spot.
Right. So it's, you know, everything in the garage is coming through that PA system. We don't understand any of this kind of stuff. We just went to Radio Shack and bought a microphone.
Right.
Literally, we like went and, oh, $16? We want that mic. You know, that's what we did.
Wait, now, how good was your singer?
He wasn't good.
No. Because that might be a deal breaker. Yeah.
Well, the problem is you're 13 years old and everybody's voices are changing.
Right.
Right. So, you know, he was great on stage. He was great. He thought he was David Lee Roth. It was great. I remember he had all these bandanas tied around his shins, and he would jump off the drum riser and do the splits because he took karate. He thought he was David Lee Roth. It was great. And the music sounded nothing like Van Halen. If anything, we sounded like the first two Def Leppard records, like On Through the Night and High and Dry, that kind of stuff. That, you know, real kind of basic two guitar. I was playing an SG and the other guitar player was playing a Strat, and we had some old Fender amps, and I used an MXR Distortion Plus.
Oh, wow.
And the second I tuned it or turned it on, it would just scream. Just, it was just, I knew nothing. You know, it was good times though, man. It was innocent. And we played at the Troubadour, and we did that one gig, and we sold it out. And ever since then, I've been working since then. You know, different bands in high school.
That's cool. You got the gig.
That's such a great story.
We got the gig. You know, so I was in various hair bands, for lack of a better term, in the 80s. But the problem was, in those days, being a teenager wasn't good like it is now. Now record labels, well, I mean, it's a whole different business structure now, but... Then they didn't want you to be teenagers. You're too young. When you're 18 years old, you know. I remember I got offered a gig touring with Cher when I was 19. And when they found out how old I was, they said, oh, we didn't know you were so young. Sorry.
Yeah.
I was like, you heard me. Like, they saw me playing at the Roxy one night. And
well, when you played at the Troubadour, how late did you play?
Well, what he did was...
Because there was a labor law.
He gave us a gig on like a Wednesday night. And we said, no, man. We can't. It's a school night. You have to give us a Saturday night, you know? And he said, I'm not giving you Saturday nights. Look at the schedule. And I looked at the schedule. And like Saturday night was, I mean, it's, when I say these names, you're not going to believe it. But it was just, it was Rat. It was Dawkin. It was Great White. It was Wasp. It was like all these bands, Poison, Cinderella, like all these bands that became huge, iconic bands before they were big. We're talking early 80s now, right? And he's like, I can put these five bands on a night together and have them start at 8 and be done by 11 and clear the room and bring in another and then sell it out again and have these guys do a second show at 11 p.m. He goes, so why am I going to let you come in with your 12-year-old friends and your 13-year-old friends? And we're like, we can't play on a school night. It's never going to happen with our parents. It's never going to happen. So he just really wanted to work with us, this guy. He was very, you know, kind of curmudgeon-y, but he obviously bent over backwards to accommodate us. And he said, why don't I put you guys on a Sunday night when you don't have school on a Monday? Nice. Like a three-day weekend. So we did that. And it was great. And we packed that place. It was packed.
There was the child labor laws. When we used to, when my brother and I played, you couldn't play after 10.
Huh. Oh, no, we didn't. We were on at 8 and we were off by 8.
Yeah, you had to be.
And you can't stay in there if you're not on stage.
No, because there's no age limit at the Troubadour. So we could stay in there.
They serve food
there.
Okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't a bar.
Right. We couldn't play at Gazzari's. And we could play at the Roxy. And we couldn't play at Gazzari's, and I think at the Whiskey we'd be 18, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember. But yeah, there were things like that. If our parents were there and we got immediately on stage and off and left the building, it was okay.
Then you could play and then you're out of there. Yeah.
Our parents were cool. Our parents were like, you're playing at the Whiskey? Let's go. You know, all the aunts and uncles are there, the cousins, everybody's there.
Yeah, the
there,
whole
you know?
Family.
Their whole family. It would be sold out. But from that gig was how I got my first professional gig years later. Because I have my godmother has a sister, and she married a man named Dan Hamilton. And he was the lead singer and guitar player in a band called Hamilton, Joe, Frank, and Reynolds.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh.
So he.
Wait, what's their big song?
Baby, Baby, Fallin'.
Yeah,
baby,
yeah. Baby, we were just talking about that the other day.
Don't Pull Your Love Out on Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. He came to those Troubadour shows when I was a little kid. You know, he was like Uncle Dan, you know what I mean? And he pulled my parents aside and he says, look, the band is just not very good. But Jay's got a future. He's got like a natural ability that I would say you should definitely nurture. Yeah.
That's cool.
And I'm the only one from all those guys that plays music still. I mean, some of them play for fun and whatever, but they all have other careers. Yeah.
Do you guys ever get together and just jam?
You know, we did about 5-6 years ago. We rented a studio out here in the Valley and played the old tunes. And it was fun. You know, it was fun. I mean, they you know, I remember the drummer came up to me and he's like, so do I sound good? Like, do I still play good? I was like, yeah, man. Like, he's a natural. You know, he can play. He's the kind of guy, like, if he played every day like I play, he'd be a phenomenal drummer because he has that natural ability. He really does. Just, I think there's a lot of luck. So Dan Hamilton started hiring me for Hamilton, Joe, Frank, and Reynolds gigs when they would play locally. Mm-hmm. And then when I turned 21, they would bring me on the road with them. And they let me do my thing. They're like, learn the songs, you know, but like when you take solos, just go nuts, man. Like that's what they wanted. They wanted just a young, They wanted some youth in the band is what they wanted, you know? They were all the age I am now, and I was 20 years old.
Right.
21, 22, going on the road with them. Yeah, it was fun. And I was doing recording with Sly Stone at the same time as I was touring with them. It was kind of all happening at the same time.
That's an interesting difference. Because that's a pretty funky thing.
You know, Sly was again, just luck and who you know. You know, my stepfather was Sly's accountant.
Oh, wow.
And he called me up and said, I'm going to see Sly today. He needs me to bring him some money. So throw your amp in the car, and I want him to hear you play.
Wow, that's awesome.
And that was it. And I went to a studio in Hollywood, and Sly was there, and really, I literally wheeled in. I wheeled in a Marshall 412 and a JCM 800 head with my Charvel San Dimas, one volume knob, one pickup, Floyd Rose, right? I walked into this big fancy studio on Vine. It's not there anymore. And quickly plugged in my stuff. And Sly was just so nice and just wanted to be accommodating to my stepdad. And just like, yeah, okay, kid, let me hear you play. You know, he wasn't dismissive. He was very open to it. And let's hear you play. And I remember he played some kind of funky, you know, like just funk. It was funk. It was funky music. And I started playing in... I said, what do you want? Do you want me to like play rhythm on it? He goes, no, man, go ahead. Just do your thing on it. And I remember I just started just being shred monster all over the stuff. And I looked through the glass into the control room and Sly's in there waving his arms in the air. And I said to myself, oh man, he's pissed. You know, he's like, what did you bring this? I mean, I had hair down to here, you know. What did you bring this
kid,
this long-haired white boy, you know, shredder guy in here? Don't you know I'm like the guy who invented funk music, you know? And he stopped the music. And I was just like very sheepish. I said, everything okay? And he goes, he hits a talkback button. And he had that deep gravelly voice. He goes, I'm going to play that one more time. Do what you just did. I want to record it. And that was it.
Oh my.
That was it. And from that on I recorded with Sly for about 2 or 3 years. I never did a gig with him.
Wow.
I was his personal guitar player. He taught me a lot. He was very patient and he would let me play, you know, what I wanted to play. He would just, you know, he would play some kind of bass line and drum groove and he'd say, just play a part, you know, I just play some.
Yeah.
You know, something like that for like 8-10 minutes straight. And he'd sit there with a pencil writing down counter numbers on the ADATs. And then he'd play it back and go, I like what you did here. Let's work on this. Let's make this a part.
Huh.
And that was it. That was a couple of years doing that with him. It was
yeah,
great.
No, that's how you get that feel. You can tell you have that feel.
None of that ever came out. None of that music was ever released.
Wow.
I'm so upset. I probably played on 30 or 40 songs. Yeah. And none of that stuff ever got released.
But it gave you the chops.
It gave me the chops. He taught me about time. I was just telling this story the other day. He taught me how to lay back because he said to me one time I was doing, you know, a part like what I just played. And he said, I need you to lay back. And I went. I just literally laid back in my chair and he started laughing and he said, no, I need you to like put your time back more. I need you to kind of lay behind the beat more. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And he went in the house and he brought out a Police CD and a Led Zeppelin CD. And he played the Police record for me. And I think it was like, like Demolition Man or something like that. And he's like, listen to this drumming. You know, he's like, there's a metronome happening and he's playing like literally right with that metronome. He goes, I need you to kind of play a little behind that. And then he put on and he said, you know, listen to this drummer, man. Listen now. It's just, bah, just behind. And then he sat there and tapping on my knee like this, just like facing me, just tapping on my knee. And he wanted me to just bury with his knee, just right with his knee, right with him tapping on my knee. And then he'd gradually kind of slow up a little bit, and I'd have to lock with him. He said he didn't want to hear any flamming, no flamming at all. And literally working with me, he didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
You know, he could have said, get Ray Parker Jr. in here. You know, he was patient and took that time and like taught me how to play on top, how to play right on the beat, how to play behind the beat. Because certain times he wanted me to do different things with feels.
Yeah.
And it was really cool. A
lot of newer guitar players don't understand that when you have to push it.
Right.
Or lay right from it.
Because now they just beat detect of everything. You know, everything's put in a computer and we highlight it and hit one key command and boom, it's all perfect.
Yeah. Until it comes time to play live.
And then they hire me. Yeah.
But it's interesting, though, that they that style of playing, I wish we heard more of that, because it's a lot of people are not exposed to that, that kind of funky groove and
right.
how to play like that.
It's, right.
You don't see it as much in today's music in a lot of the gigs. You're not hearing as much, and that's very important part of it to be able to do that.
Yeah, I'm trying to pull up the sound right here. I'm still learning how to use this thing.
You can't see it because it's on the floor, but he's using a Helix from Line 6.
Who else brought that in?
There were several people who used it.
There, now
I can't think of it.
Cool. Because that patch I was on was only had dirt. Lots of dirt and grease.
Well, let's play a clip, because I want to show what's really interesting. I want to talk a little bit about how you record, then we'll get into the gear a little bit more.
Okay.
I'm going to play this first clip, and it's called Solace, and it's from Gatronica, and I'm going to flash the album over here. And listen to what he's doing. It's really interesting. First of all, the tone of the guitar is killer, and we'll get into the amps and what he's doing. But also, there's like a pan delay. And it's phased. It's a pretty radical phase, but it's like ping ponging. Then it with the phasing, it kind of disappears and comes back. And it's really, I haven't now. We were talking before the show, and I was comparing his tone, what I was hearing on the album, a lot to Gilmore. But also, you use echo creatively. He was one of the guys that I saw would do a lot of interesting things, but. Some of the stuff that you're doing with the ping ponging, it's not cliche. It's really cool.
Thank you.
What you're doing. So,
and I do that for the 1 in 100 person like you that actually can hear that.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't hear it, and I don't care because I hear it. But every once in a while, somebody like you hears that. And there was time that went into that.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't just a button I pushed.
Now, for you on Facebook Live, it's the feed's mono, so you won't hear it. But if you listen to if you download the audio from the radio show on the archives, it is in stereo. Because what he's doing with the Helix right now, too, we have it set up panned hard left and right. So he's doing stereo stuff on here. But let me go ahead and play this. This is Solace. This is really cool. Now, that's a, there's some great stuff that you're doing in there.
Thank you.
Now, one of the things we were talking about before the show, there was an edit there, actually, too, also. He goes, right, there's much more to this song. It develops a lot more. But what he's doing is that opening guitar, it's very clean, but it's really sustaining.
Right.
And it's like, so I was asking him, one of the ways you get that sound is turning your amp up and playing, you know, really cranking it and playing loud but clean.
Right.
So we were talking, tell us a little bit about the development of some of those sounds.
So the way I did get that sound was, so first of all the effects you're hearing are plugins.
Okay.
I didn't track anything wet. I work with a guy named Julian Chan, who's the producer, and he co-wrote a couple of the songs with me, and he produced the record with me. And he's just a brilliant guy, and he's, you know, a lot of guys who are great knob turners aren't creative as well. And he is very creative, as well as playing many instruments. He plays many different instruments. So I love working with him, and I trust him. And I can send him tracks, and he'll send me something back and be like, hey, in this song, listen to what you did there at like 2 minutes and 15 seconds. And I listen back to it, and he goes, and I'll go, yeah. And he goes, that's what you meant to do? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, you sure that's what you meant to do? And I'm like, yes. He's like, I think you can do better, you know? He pushes me like that, and I don't get offended by it at all, because I trust him.
Mm. He really breaks it apart and analyzes. Yeah,
I don't think it's wise for people to mix their own music, and I don't think it's wise for people to self-produce really that much. Mm. I mean, we're not all Prince. We're not all Lenny Kravitz. We can't all have that thing where we can step aside from ourselves and objectively know this is great or this is garbage or this is derivative or whatever adjectives you want to find. And again, those Prince has a humongous body of work that a lot of people have never even heard. And now some of it might be released, and maybe Prince didn't want us to hear it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Maybe it wasn't up to what he thought was.
Probably.
Because he was able to listen to something in a third person and say, that's not what I want.
Yeah.
It's not up to my level of what I know.
There's
a reason why he shelved it. Exactly. Yeah.
That was just in process stuff.
So having said that, I trust this Julian Chan guy, and he's a genius. He's great. So I tracked these tunes. I wanted my first record identity was a mishmash of styles. It was every song was a different style, tons of overdubs, tons of guitar. There'd be one song with, you know, eight different guitar parts doing different things and different styles. There was a smooth jazz song. There was a, you know, song that sounded like Chick Corea's Electric Band. There was pretty acoustic stuff that sounded like John Mayer. I mean, it was just all over the map stylistically. This album, I wanted it to have a sound. I wanted this album to say, hey, I'm an artist. And this is my style.
Right.
And this is the direction I'm in.
Cool.
So I decided I'm using one amp and one guitar on this whole album. And that's what this is. So what I did was I used a Bogner Shiva with EL34s. And I plugged it into a device that looks like a cigar box, kind of. It's made by a company called Radial. They make all the DI boxes and things. And it's called the Headload. And what this thing does is it does two things. It shows your amp a load, so you don't need to use a cabinet, as well as being a volume attenuator, like a power brake or something like that.
Yeah.
So I would literally crank the crap out of the amp. I think the amp pretty dimed out. It got to a point where when I wasn't getting any more tonal benefit from it, but I was just getting more noise, that was when I stopped to turn it up. So that was in the, I think, 8 range. If I had been plugged into a cabinet, it would have been, you know, a Bogner Shiva on 8. I don't need to tell you how loud that is. Right.
No.
So that was the overdrive channel of the Bogner 8, not with the boost on. And I would use the neck pickup on a guitar, on one of my Tyler guitars. And I would use various different DiMarzio pickups. I tried, you know, ones that are stacked, ones that aren't stacked. I tried twin blade ones. I tried all kinds. And they're all on the record. But what I basically did was so if you have, like, here's a pretty high gain sound. Now, that's a single coil pickup. As
right.
you can hear, the 60 cycle hum. That's if I go into the in-between position. So it's a real 60 cycle hum on a real Strat pickup. And it sounds like a humbucker because I'm using so much gain.
Right.
But I brought the volume knob down to like 2 or 3 on the guitar. And that's how I got the tone. It's with the volume knob on the guitar. The amp is cranked. And I have the head load So it's going from the guitar straight into the Bogner going into the radial head load, going into a tube mic preamp. I use different ones. I use either an API or an ART, MPA2, whichever one sounded better for that given song. And then I would take the outputs of that into a Summit Audio TLA-50 tube compressor.
Oh, okay. So you did. Okay. So
but just to touch it, I didn't actually compress. I mean, the needle barely moved. I just wanted the more tube warmth straight into Pro Tools.
Because that cranking that amp, that you are getting some compression from the tubes.
Absolutely. But because I'm not hitting the front end of it hard, because the guitar, like I said, the pickup's only on two or three. And you can hear, if you listen really carefully, you can hear times when I'm like, I'm.
Oh, so you're bringing the volume up as you play?
Absolutely. I always am playing with my volume knob.
And you use your finger, not
I
a
use
pedal.
My pinky. No, I never use a pedal. Well, I shouldn't say never, but if I'm using my big Bradshaw rig, I use a volume pedal, because then I'm using a pedal placed properly. It's after the preamp.
Right, right.
Whereas when you're using combo amps, it's difficult to do that unless you have a situation with effects loops and all that kind of stuff. So that's really the trick to almost all the tone on that. And all as far as those fancy delays are concerned, I would pull up either like Sound Toys Crystallizer. I use that one a lot. And I would just tweak settings. And then,
did you print those delays and then he played with them, or did you just told him?
I would give him my session. So I would upload my entire session to a Dropbox, and then Julian would pull the session down and he'd see what I had going on. And I don't know what he does then. He probably doesn't use anything that I gave him. He probably doesn't. And this is the idea of what I'm going for, Julian. Mm-hmm. And he knows it, and he makes it not sound like a guitar player who's, doing his own thing. He makes the magic. So all that cool sparkly crap on the delays and all that, I mean, it's really Julian. It really is.
Well, I'm going to play another clip. I'm going to play Solitude, where he really get that glassy.
And this is a different. Solitude is the only song where I used a different amp and guitar. I used a Blankenship.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Twinplex Junior, which I think I have the only one. He custom made this amp for me, but I know he'll make others. I mean, he would make other people one if they wanted. And I used a 63, it's a Fender Custom Shop, 63 Mike Landau model. It's the kind of Fiesta Red one that mm-hmm. they sell, and it's stock.
Now, the Blankenship, you did the same thing. It went through the...
Yes.
That same...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
Let's play this, because this is the tone to die for.
Thank you, man.
This is
Thank
really
you.
Cool. Just so glassy, and then when you go down to the lower strings, mm-hmm. it's just that tone. You can hear the overtones of those round ones.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's
See, neat. When I hear that, because I haven't listened to this in a long time, when I hear that, I know where my headspace was when I was playing it, and it's funny because you might hear Gilmore, but I'm hearing Neil Sean.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm hearing, you know...
I'm
I'm hearing lights. Right. Like that's
Journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a big Sean fan.
Yeah, but those yeah. when you're playing the lead up top and you're playing that sound, that's not a Sean sound.
No, it's not. It's not. I mean, he gets some tones that, you know, like on Who's Crying Now, the guitar solo that. Now, if you hear him play it live, he's fully gained out. He's, you know. If you listen to the album, it's a clean tone. It's a clean, really compressed tone.
Yeah.
Kind of like the solo. And to me, I never talked to him about this, but to me, it sounds like he was trying to channel. Because if you listen to that solo from Another Brick in the Wall, again, it's not a very dirty sound. It's like you said at the beginning. It's got a little grit to it, but it's got sustain and compression and everything.
Yeah, right. When you turn up the amp, what I call it is bloom. It just gets that little bit of that harmonic distortion.
Did you know that that's a Les Paul on that?
Yeah.
With a P90?
Yeah.
Blew my mind.
Everybody was discussing that.
Right.
He actually used a Les Paul.
Yeah, it made sense. When I read that, I found this website. It was like Gilmourish.com. That's what it's called. Every piece of gear he used, his entire signal chain.
That's great.
Even like in the studio Apple gear.
Yeah.
For every song. And I was like, no way. Les Paul. And it makes sense because it's so fat. There's at the very end, you hear that. You hear like that 1176 open. Like when he does those last. You know?
Yeah.
No, oh, man. I could just geek out on gear stuff all day long.
No, but the thing that I thought was in interesting about this album, and I recommend it, is because the only other guy that really uses a lot of the glassy sound live is Eric Johnson.
Right.
But this is totally different.
Yeah.
It's a different, it's that tone, but it's different the way you approach it. And part of it's what you're using. And how you're playing it. You're playing much, you're holding the notes, you're milking it more.
Right.
Which I think is nice because you'll hit that, you'll hold the note and then you'll just like, at the very end, whoop, you'll bend up a little bit or you'll use the whammy bar or whatever. And it's just tasty.
Thank you, man. Thank you very much.
And I think that that's important because that sound is really what that guitar. I mean, this is a Tyler, but it's basically a Strat design.
Right.
But that tone, people forget that. And, you know, if you even listen to some of the earlier Hendrix stuff, he uses that sound
yes,
a lot.
Absolutely.
And it's a very cool sound that sometimes
Castle's made of sand, man.
Yeah.
You know?
And
yeah.
It's forgotten and it's like it needs, you're bringing it back, which I think is good because that really is the one of the main things that makes the Strat so unique is that sound. It's just cool.
I agree. When I buy Strats or plug into Strats, that's like I only listen to the neck pickup. I don't really care what the other two are doing, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying I don't use them because I'm definitely a bridge pickup guy, but mm-hmm. the neck pickup's got to sound. I'm not going to buy a Strat if when I'm playing it in the shop or from a person or it doesn't sound great. I'm not going to go, well, I can try another pickup because it's a never-ending nightmare for me with pickups. I go through pickups like Ron Jeremy goes through women. I can't.
You're never happy with one.
Seriously, I'll love one, and then one night it won't sound right to me.
And then he takes it out.
And then that's it. The next day I'm putting a different pickup in it. And I have to, literally, if you look on the back of my headstock right here, there's a piece of tape. All of my guitars have this piece of tape. And on that piece of tape, it tells me which pickups are in this guitar right now.
Oh, wow.
Yes, because I change them so often.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
And this guitar actually has two completely different pre-wired pick guards that I switch between. One of them's got three singles with a reverse angled bridge.
Because mm-hmm.
it makes no sense to me why this pickup should be angled this way. It should be angled that way.
Well, you get more of that Hendrix thing. I think they did it so you got more bite in the...
Back in the early days when amps didn't have...
When you were surfing.
Right.
But I'm going to play another clip, and this is I want everybody to listen because he does another cool thing with the echo. Now,
uh-oh.
I'm going to ask you about this one because when you hear the guitar echo, the echoes, the tone is totally different than what he's playing. And I'm sure it's an echo. So I want to ask you what you did, because it's a really, this is called Esoterica. And take a listen to this, because it's really, it's very cool. I mean, what he's doing is everything's changing. It's organic, where the echoes actually are totally different parts on those, so to speak, instead of a junk type of thing. So
anybody
I mean, it makes, it's ear candy, as
right,
I call it.
So exactly.
Here, listen to this, Esoterica.
That right? So that, can't believe I'm admitting this to anybody right now. That came from my love of this Argent song.
Yeah, hear it.
Right? I was like, you know, that's what that is. That's where that came from. To come then, I just wanted to do something that was like, there's that solo right there. Just in that little snippet you played, there's so many little odes to people. There's a Ritchie Blackmore thing in there that. Like, there's a thing I do, like, it's straight out of Stone Cold.
Mm-hmm.
Stone Cold, I can't do, you know, the Joel and Turner thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part, there's a passage in one of the solos where he does, like, this just really staccato arpeggio. That I did a little ode to him in there. There's the Van Halen.
Yeah, I heard that.
Right. There's a lot of Halen in my playing.
But there's what's interesting is the tonality. He's using that same amp and that same guitar.
Right.
And listen to the different tones. When you get even when you get in the lead, you get towards the end, you start squawking more.
Right.
You know, and you but that's all just the guitar and the amp.
Right.
That's the point I want to make is he's doing that with just a guitar and amp. There's no pedals. There's processing later.
Right.
And you caught what I was saying with the echo. That was cool.
Again, I got to give Julian, Chan props for that stuff. You know, I might have said to him, I'd like it repeating. And then he made it, you know, he obviously filtered it and then fed it through something else.
Because, I mean, I wonder if he reamped some of it because it sounds like a different.
It's quite possible that he did that, he reamped it. He's an evil genius. And and I give him complete carte blanche, not complete, but most of the time, very once in a while, I say, I really don't like that. Like you went a little past the line on that one. But usually it's like, wow, you know?
Yeah, no, this is definitely an album to listen in headphones. Because there's so much going on.
Absolutely.
And the stereo spread is amazing.
And when did it come out?
It's not technically out yet.
Oh.
I finished it at the beginning of this year.
Well, make your pitch here.
Yeah. Yeah, I am. I'm.
I do see. Do
you
see
definitely have to? Put
yeah,
this
I'm
on
working.
Amazon.
I'm working with some. You know, talking with some labels. So I don't want to release it by myself because I don't want the labels to say, "Oh, well, you've already released it. So, what are we going
to
do now?"
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Make a whole other one.
Yeah. Well, I will work on it. But believe me, this is the direction I'm going in. You know, it came from me having this love of these bands like Enigma and Massive Attack and Portishead and. You know, that kind of stuff. And I thought, there's no guitar in that stuff. And if I could write really cool electronic music, that kind of mid-tempo, sexy Euro kind of stuff, and then put guitar melodies on it and not make it too wheedly, 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 I think I have something that hasn't been done before.
I have to mention, too, the rhythm tracks are just killer.
A lot of that is Rodney Lee.
That's just funky.
And Julian Chan, you know, tons of programming. Rodney Lee is a keyboard player that I've worked with when I toured with Mindy Airbear for 10 years. Yeah. He was our keyboard player. And he has this thing he does called Satellite Orchestra. And it's a lot of kind of stuff like that. And I told him the concept that I wanted to do. I said I wanted to do this really cool stuff with really amazing loops and textures, lots of textures. And I don't want anything that I wrote on guitar, I didn't play on guitar. Like Solitude is that I wrote that on a guitar. I wrote that at 4 o'clock in the morning. I had just bought a Strymon Timeline and I set up in a spare room in my house, 2 4-12 cabinets facing me. And I plugged the Strymon into a stereo VHT power amp and it was against the wall and I sat with those cabinets facing me. It was literally 4 o'clock in the morning. And I was just going through presets. And I had like the Strymon up on like a TV tray and my guitar, and I came up with that.
That's a great riff.
But I didn't want it to be on guitar because when I play it live, I don't want people going, "Where's that guitar coming from?"
Yeah,
you know. So I had Rodney play it on a Rhodes or whatever he played it on. I might have even played it.
No, the. I read you. This you got to let me know when this is out. Cause people have to get this. This is really, really. This is a great album. I love the tone.
Thank you. What you're doing
guitar wise, and I think that's important in using amps and using just how he's using the guitar and the technique playing with it. Then and it's also rich with effects too. But what I want to do real quick, we're almost out of time, and I want to set up the last song. But what's going on? Where are you playing? Where can people see you? I know your website is www.jgore.com.
Correct. I do Monday nights at Harvell's in Santa Monica. With CeCe Thomas. And what we do is we use the night. It's a jam night. And, you know, we'll play everything from Herbie Hancock to Stevie Wonder to Pat Benatar. I mean, just... There's no rules, really, of what we'll play. We might play a swing tune. We might play a bebop tune. We might play a Parliament P-Funk tune or James Brown. You just never know what we're going to play. World-class musicians coming in, sitting in all night.
And singers, too, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Shaka Khan, whatever you want to hear, we're going to play it. And we have guest musicians all night, and we use the night as a fundraiser for a music school called Raffia Music Studio. And so that kids that can't afford guitar lessons or piano or drums or music lessons, this pays for that.
Very cool.
And I'm also a musical director for a thing called Rock for Israel, and which is an organization. We want to bring musicians to start touring in Israel, start doing gigs, and have it be a whole cultural thing. Not just go there and do concerts, but really.
I think that's great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to take us out with, this is a lengthy clip, and I edited it together. This is called Dissonant Illusion from the album. And he does a lot of different styles in this. So there's like the octave Wes Montgomery thing right at the beginning, and then it goes out to a full blowout lead that's really cool. Thank you so much. We just barely touched the surface. You have to come back.
Anytime. I'm happy to do it.
What I'd like you to do is bring that setup that you used with the head and the direct and we'll plug it in. We got to show that.
It's a really cool thing, man.
We got
to props to Radial, because that's a really nice piece of gear.
So anyway, the album's Gatronica. We'll let you know as soon as it comes out. But this is great.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
And Lori, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, another great one.
Anything else you need real quick to
Just let people know about the tribe's next big benefit show, the All-Star Benefit that we have coming to the Kenyon Club in Agora Hills on the 3rd of July for homelessness in L.A. We're benefiting three organizations, Hope of the Valley Rescue Mission, My Stuff Bags Foundation, and the Midnight Mission. So come out and support us and see a great concert.
Thank you. Now, this is Dissonant Illusion. Check this out. Everybody have a great week. We'll see you next week. Thanks again for coming on.